It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In cities across the country, including here in Pittsburgh, activists are calling for big changes in law enforcement. Everything from abolishing the police to shifting some funds to community-based programs. Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto has now created a 17-member community task force on police reform. Longtime public servant Valerie McDonald Roberts has been named as the co-chair. Valerie, what were your marching orders from the mayor?
He wanted a broad and diverse group of people who are tasked with looking at what we're doing here in Pittsburgh to make sure that we bring community people's voices into the fold in terms of a plan of recommendation for him.
One of your tasks as a commission is to review police practices. Do you plan to involve law enforcement in the task force's work, and how so?
Absolutely. It's funny you asked that, because I sent an email early this morning questioning when we would have the input of the police force and of HR, because we're talking about a collective bargaining agreement. We're talking about procedures in terms of personnel. What Chief of Staff Van Gilman responded is that, of course, all staff will be available to the task force for questions, for input, et cetera. So it will be a collaborative effort.
Are you hearing anything from the FOP at this point?
I'm not sure if the task force conversations is to involve the FOP. I'm not sure. What we're going to do, we're going to meet. We're going to establish where we want to go. It's going to be 17 as a group that's going to come together and figure this out on behalf of the city of Pittsburgh at the behest of Mayor Peduto.
And how will you allow for public input?
You know, boy, you must have been in my car this morning when I was sending all these emails. We're going to figure out how this can be transparent to the general public without having, you know, an entire room, so to speak. I know that's antiquated in this new norm now. It'll probably be a very big Zoom call. But we will figure that out as to how to make sure that the public is aware of what we're doing and, most importantly, has input.
During your varied career, whether it was a city councilor or chief of Pittsburgh's Bureau of Neighborhood Empowerment, or even just as a longtime resident of this area, you've heard the issue of police reform raised before. Will this time be any different? And if so, why so?
It will be, Kevin. When I came on city council in 1994, the first issue I tackled was police reform. And I remember going to the table in 1995, being the only woman, bringing non-binding resolutions of police reform. You could hear a pin drop in that room in the city council chambers. It was that quiet and deafening. And I realized we've hit a nerve. So no, police reform is definitely not new to me. But what is different now is that we have numerous voices at the table. We have them on the streets. We have them basically screaming to the heavens that we want reform. That was not necessarily the case. And you know what, Kevin, what really is great? We don't just have the old heads. We don't have the people that have been in the civil rights trenches for years. We have fresh blood. We have so many young people, a diverse group of young people, and they mean it, and they do not have, you know, they're not getting tired. There is no fatigue going on. That's what is so different and refreshing about this.
While your group is just really beginning its work, City Council is considering bills by Ricky Burgess and Daniel Lavelle that would bar the city from buying military equipment for police and would require officers to intervene if they witness another officer using excessive force or violating someone's rights, and to even transfer money from the police budget into violence prevention. Do you support those measures?
Kevin, back in 1995, I supported those measures as far as the militaristic type of mentality that is there, as far as de-escalation techniques. So, yes, we will look at all of those measures. I'm not sure if there'll be modifications, but it's going to be 17 of us that are going to deliberate and talk about this as a group, and we'll see.
You're supposed to make your recommendations sometime in the fall. What can you do to make sure that the document doesn't sit on a shelf, that the recommendations are actually implemented?
There is only one way to make sure that the document doesn't sit on the shelf, and that is to have someone in leadership to make it happen. And right now, we are fortunate that we have a mayor that is serious. This is not lip service. This is not a nice book to have in your background as you're doing your Zoom call. This is not like that. This is going to be a working document. I love policy, but you know what I love the most? Implementation. I like to see actions. I like to see outcomes. I don't care who gets credit for it. I just want to see outcomes. This is not just one person making up the rules or individually elected officials or anything. City councils made recommendations, the state. We will look at all that and make a collective recommendation report for the mayor to do implementation. He's going to get out of this group a diversified background of input, how the city should move forward in terms of public safety, what is best for this region, what is best for this city.
Just a note, the task force also includes David Harris, a University of Pittsburgh law professor and WESA's legal analyst, as well as Angela Reynolds, the CEO of the YWCA and an upcoming guest on The Confluence. Valerie McDonald-Roberts is the co-chair of the mayor's newly formed Community Task Force on Police Reform. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for your time.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. An inspection last month by the State Department of Health of the Brighton Rehabilitation and Wellness Center in Beaver County discovered violations that put residents into immediate jeopardy. Sean Hamill, the Post-Gazette, has reported extensively on the pandemic's impact on the Brighton Center. Sean, remind us, Brighton has had the worst COVID-19 outbreak in the state.
It has. Among all the known reporting that is done on nursing facilities, long-term care facilities, Brighton has the single most number of positive cases among residents. It has the most positive cases among employees, and it has the single most number of deaths. That's the most recent data.
Those are very, very troubling numbers. What stands out to you?
The facility told us when they began at the end of March, when they've made their first report, that there were about 460 people who lived there. And right now, with 332 positive cases and 82 people having died, and the current census is only 331, which means that almost everyone who's remaining in the building has tested positive for this. And that is just shocking. The numbers are big, too, and I should note this, that Brighton is the fourth largest nursing home in the entire state. There are only three that have more beds than Brighton. Now, it wasn't completely full. It has 589 possible beds, so it was about a quarter empty. And employees have told us the only reason it wasn't full was the management has had a hard time finding enough employees to staff the facility. Mm. And that was even true with the reduced numbers at 460. So they have some units in the facility that aren't even used. It's scary to think what would happen if there were another, say, 120 people living there. I don't think there's any reason to think that it would have prevented the number from being even higher.
There was an earlier inspection in April. Didn't that lead to any improvements?
Well, it's unclear to us after that one-day inspection in April what the inspector or inspectors told the facility the day they left, if they ordered them to make any changes. The facility was given the inspection report at least a couple weeks later, and because the next inspection was on May 5th, nothing had changed in those 2 weeks since that April 17th inspection. Hmm. Nothing really had changed when it came to infection prevention. They were still violating the most basic infection controls that they noted on April 17th. Hmm. That is just absolutely horrifying to the residents' families, both those who have died and those who are still there, because this has been their concern all along. You know, was the facility doing what they were supposed to? From mid-April to the end of April is when the largest number of residents died. So as the inspectors are coming back at the beginning of May, and the outbreak within the building is at full rage. They're finding dozens of people infected every day. staff members are getting positive results every day, and unfortunately, more people are dying every day.
So tell us, what does immediate jeopardy mean?
That means that the actions of the staff are actually putting the residents in immediate harm. It can be as minimal as becoming infected, but the law itself says potential fatal outcomes. Not because they were egregious, like they weren't, you know, there were not people walking in there without gowns and masks on, but they were doing things as basic as not washing their hands in between seeing a patient who had COVID-19 and going into a room with patients who didn't have COVID-19. And when you do that, you're supposed to take your gloves off, throw them away, wash your hands before you touch anything in the next room. They weren't doing that. And because that happened over and over and over again, just in the first 2 days they were there, there are serious repercussions when you have a declaration of immediate jeopardy, up to and including if you can't comply with the plan of action that they put in place, they can shut you down. Now, that didn't happen here. By the end of the fourth day, the state had removed the immediate jeopardy. And what they had asked them to do was to retrain the entire staff on infection prevention protocols. And by May 4th, they had done that. And May 5th, they issued their final report and had a meeting with the facility management and told them everything they had found and said that the immediate jeopardy finding was removed. But there are ongoing plans of correction that they have to abide by, and which includes an ongoing fine.
Right.
And we haven't heard from the state or the federal government yet if they have fully complied with that.
Last month, the state imposed a temporary manager. Is that outside firm still in place?
It is. It's a company called Alair out of Freehold, New Jersey. We were told initially that they would have at least three staff members on site at Brighton. And as far as we know, as far as the state has updated us, they are still in place. They are still there. You know, staff have told us they've seen them in there. They are working. They were working with the National Guard when they were there last month as well. We hope to hear more when they finally leave. We hope to hear a report from them about what they found there themselves.
You mentioned that Brighton Rehab and Wellness Center is one of the largest such facilities in the state. It's privately owned. Have the owners responded to all of this?
Not directly. There's a gentleman named Sam Halper who is the managing owner. He's one of the investors in this and at least a dozen other nursing homes. We've never heard directly from him. We do hear from a spokesperson who sends us statements, not directly answering questions. For example, in response to the May 5th finding of immediate jeopardy, they responded with a statement that said that when problems have been pointed out, they have followed all state and federal guidelines to come into compliance. But that's as much as we've heard. We've never heard an explanation from the owners themselves about why this happened, why they believe it happened, measures they took early on. We just don't know really what the owners have said. We've never been able to interview anybody from ownership in the entire now almost three full months since this began. Initially, we heard from their medical director, Dr. Dave Timmons, but they haven't allowed him to speak to us since the second week of the outbreak in early April.
Sean, finally, are follow-up inspections planned? Do you know?
The straight answer is we never really know because the state doesn't announce if they're going to go back because of a complaint from a resident or a resident's family. Again, if a resident's family calls tomorrow and says, hey, you know, here's a violation. I saw it happen myself or I heard it from my mother or my father who lives in there, they would respond and they would go in because they're supposed to. But each of the three inspections that have taken place, they follow the same protocol. They map out the problems they find. They tell you what the violations are. And then the last thing they do is they map out a plan of correction. And in that plan of correction, it talks about they're going to have to audit themselves and report back. And the state's going to follow up. We don't know in any of those cases, and now we're two full months since that first one, we don't know the outcome of that yet. We hope to learn soon from the state, though.
Sean Hamill is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. You can read his work at postgazette.com. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. People looking for a new way to safely enjoy their favorite downtown eateries are in luck. The Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership has announced plans to work with the city of Pittsburgh, business owners, and others to expand outdoor dining and walking space downtown. Chris Watts is the Vice President for Mobility for the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. Chris, what brought about this idea? Was there just not enough indoor space to distance socially, or what?
A couple things brought about this idea, Kevin. As we know, since March, it's been a really challenging time for many of our businesses downtown and many people throughout the region. And we've been surveying and talking to our stakeholders to understand what we can do on behalf of downtown to make it a, you know, first priority, a safe experience, but also begin to welcome people back to downtown in a way that can support our small businesses.
Right. So give us an idea briefly what street sidewalk modifications are planned and any priority locations.
So we identified a few priority corridors that we're ready to deploy some outdoor seating in downtown. That's on 6th Street between Liberty Avenue and Fort Duquesne, on Penn Avenue between 9th and 10th Street in the Cultural District, Market Square, of course, as well as Strawberry Way.
Mm-hmm. Will there be expansions to other downtown locations as the summer moves along?
We invite any business in downtown or any restaurant to let us know. We've done extensive outreach. We certainly welcome anyone that wants to look into it. And it may not be an entire corridor. It may just be a parking space or two. But we're open to working with businesses downtown to see how they can operate with some of the restrictions that they have on occupancy.
Obviously, you're excited about this, but do you still have any concerns? Are you hearing any concerns from anyone about still maintaining social distancing while dining outside?
Yeah, that's top of mind. I mean, when we deployed this was when the state transitioned Allegheny County to the green phase that allowed for outdoor dining. And so we're encouraging all of our businesses to follow state and federal CDC guidelines on appropriate usage of their space and table distancing, but we're also going to be monitoring how things are going and talking to businesses to learn as we go. We certainly want to make sure that everyone feels comfortable and safe when they're downtown, but we also know that, you know, businesses and their employees want to do everything we can to help support them.
All right. So eating is an experience. Are you adding to that experience with any extras?
We're going to be looking throughout the summer to see how the outdoor seating experiment goes. We'd love to add some outdoor music, deployment of public art. Those are things that we're still in process of determining what is appropriate and where that should be located. That said, we intend to start deploying the outdoor seating areas in the next few weeks. Look to have outdoor dining and additional corridors downtown by early July.
Chris Watts is the Vice President for Mobility for the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.FM, where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Joya Zenkovich, and Doug Shugerts. Until next time, I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good day of good news.